From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. There are hundreds of streets in the U.S. named for Martin Luther King Jr. A documentary film called The MLK Streets Project looks at what life is like on those streets and what that says about Dr. King's legacy. We talk with one of the filmmakers. Then we talk with Shawn Michaels, author of the novel Us Conductors, about the inventor of the theremin, a musical instrument you play without touching.
It's almost like a sound that comes out of the air itself without a physical source, without a physical performance.
Plus, George Collins, who was editor-in-chief of Baltimore's Afro-American newspaper and a WMAR broadcaster, died last July at age 88. We talk about Collins' coverage of the civil rights movement in Maryland with his colleague, Charles Robinson of Maryland Public Television. Now, news.
I'm Nathan Sterner, and if you were listening to Maryland Morning Live, I'd be bringing you the latest Maryland news right about now. You can catch the live show Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 9 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 FM in Ocean City, and online at WYPR.org. For now, you're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast. Thanks for downloading us. Let's get the show underway.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. In one of his comedy specials on HBO in the 90s, Chris Rock mused about a pattern you can spot all over the country.
You know what's so sad, man? You know what's wild? Martin Luther King stood for nonviolence. Now it's Martin Luther King, a street. And I don't give a f*** where you in America. If you're on Martin Luther King Boulevard, there's some violence going down.
There are hundreds of American streets, avenues, expressways, and roads named in honor of Dr. King, including one right here in Baltimore. Motorists have been coursing along Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard since the early 80s. In 2008, a group of 10 students from D.C. visited Baltimore's MLK Boulevard and 12 other U.S. cities with streets named for the civil rights leader. The kids' observations and interviews about the positive and negative elements they found on the streets were filmed for a documentary. It was released in 2012. The students asked residents, community leaders, and academics, "Do you think these streets represent King's dream?" Last January, I spoke with Sharnice Fox Richardson, co-director of the MLK Streets Project, and asked her why they made the film.
Well, so we had just finished doing a film called Away With Words, where we wanted to talk to kids about how words create conflict or compassion in our communities. We teach social justice through documentary film is the work that we do. And once we finished that, we just got really interested on the next step, the next level of how to teach kids about social activism, and who better to do that than King. So when we started talking to them about who Dr. King was, a lot of the students just knew that I Have a Dream speech. And so when we started talking about that as a group of producers, we started thinking of how could we connect that. And a lot of our students were from Anacostia in D.C. And so we just had this idea, being children of the 90s, actually graduated high school in 1995, so I was very familiar with the Chris Rock joke. We just decided maybe we should first talk about D.C. Street. But then once we started realizing how streets connect us, we wanted to see what every other street looked like across the country and whether or not they reflected his dream. And it became really interesting. It's actually scholarly research. Derek Alderman is a professor, and he's done his doctorate thesis on the renaming of streets after Dr. King and the phenomenon across the country.
Tell us about the communities you visited.
We started at the beginning when the Jenna 6 happened. I'm not sure if you're familiar with mm-hmm. that. So we started at Jenna, which took us to New Orleans, and we were in New Orleans, and that was our first city. We spent some time in Birmingham. They were able to see the church in Birmingham that was bombed. We came back to D.C. after that. We visited Baltimore. And then we went to Oakland, and Oakland is really interesting because in the Bay Area, it starts in Oakland and moves you all the way down to Berkeley. Once you get to Berkeley, it's MLK, but there's these big houses and there's the college. USC is there and it's absolutely beautiful. So that was really interesting to see because it absolutely didn't fit the stereotype at all. And Oakland did, but Berkeley did not.
And did you see that anyplace else? Is that the only MLK of the 13 you visited where you saw that kind of
change? Yeah, the change, where it started off one way and ended up another place. Yeah, that was the only place that we saw that. The thing about streets named after King is that it's mostly concentrated in the South. That is the way that they are able to honor our civil rights leaders. And they're mostly concentrated in Black neighborhoods. Now, I'll say we never felt unsafe anywhere.
That part of the Chris Rock joke is sort of overdone from your perspective.
Well, I'll say there is truth in every stereotype. And so there's truth in every joke. I'll say that we were there during the day and that, you know, people were always willing to talk to us. But we did see a difference. You know, there were only liquor stores. There was not grocery stores. There were carryouts. There were rundown homes. There were, you know, police on the corner. So we did see those things that you wouldn't see on, let's say, Washington Street on the other side of town. And even to this day, I get Google alerts for all streets named after King across the country. And it's actually a really interesting case study. I've been doing it now since we started. So about 7 years. And I get Google alerts every single day for anything that happens across the country that on a street named after Dr. King. There are still people that get shot. There are still people that get robbed. All those things happen every single day. So this is not, it's not that it's not true. It's just that we never felt unsafe. But those things still happen on streets named after King.
Do you ever get Google alerts for something good, for good news?
This time of year, yes. Every January, you know, the churches are having their marches or, you know, there's some type of event that's happening. So this time of year, definitely.
That's Sharnace Fox Richardson here on Maryland Morning 88.1. I'm Sheila Cash. She is one of the co-directors of the MLK Streets Project. And we're talking about neighborhoods around streets named after Dr. King and about educating younger generations about his legacy. Legacy was really what motivated you.
Right.
What's your impression of the kids who traveled with you? What's your impression of what they knew?
When they started, I remember the first time we had our workshop after we picked the students to travel with us. And we said, what is your impression of King? Who is he? And everyone said, oh, he had a dream. And we were like, okay, so what's that dream? Oh, he wanted white people and black people to be friends. And we're like, okay, so what does that mean? And it was crickets, silence. No one really understood that except for, you know, like, let racism in. Well, what does that mean? Where is the bigger picture in that? How does that work? They knew nothing of the Poor People's Campaign. They had no idea about this idea of economics and how he moved to that. When he was in Memphis and he was preparing to march with the sanitation workers, it was about economics. It was about civil rights, but it was more about economics and what that looked like because they wanted equal wage. And that's something we still talk about today, right? We still have that conversation about minimum wage and what that looks like. And so their impression of King was very watered down. And, you know, once we began to really talk about him, we made them read four of his speeches. We made them really understand where he was in his life. And then we started talking about this idea of gentrification. We started talking about this idea of affordable housing. We started talking about this idea of affordable food. And it became something, they began to respect King in a way that I think that they had never thought about him before, you know. And I think that's important. Oftentimes in our history books, we are spoon-fed these pieces of who Dr. King is. And that's really not the type of activism that he promoted was completely different than what our students are taught, even today.
That phrase, watered down, I recognize from one of the interviews in your documentary with a young person from Wide Angle Youth Media here in Baltimore who used that phrase.
It becomes watered down. Like, I have a dream. Like, after a while, that dream, you gotta switch it up.
You gotta wake up.
Do you think that having these streets and boulevards named after Dr. King counteracts that watering down the dream?
No. I think it's the easiest way to honor someone, I think, a lot of times in our communities. It is hard because you have to get city council to approve it, but it's a lot easier than building a peace center for Dr. King, an educational center for Dr. King. I think that it's just the easiest way to honor someone, and I understand that. Whether or not there are other ways for us to be able to really present King in a way that allows students to honor him with the work that they do, to go out and want to be social activists, to want to go out in their communities and to seek real change, whether it's picking trash up off the floor or going to school every day so that they can become participants in their communities in a way that creates change, is something completely different. And changing the street, was, you know, whatever street it was before they renamed the King. And there were still people getting shot on the block. So is it making a huge difference? No. We have to teach them in a different way. And I think that's what the point of the movie is, too, is that, I mean, this is great, but what does it mean?
In the documentary, you or someone interviewed Harry Belafonte on that
right.
point.
Yeah.
Naming a building after him does not have to deal with the content of his life or his legacy. Naming a boulevard after him does not have to necessarily oblige anyone to deal with what he wanted for us and the speeches that he made and the things that he gave us.
What went through your mind when you heard that?
You know, Harry Belafonte first was just, it was great to for our students to have the opportunity to meet someone who knew King. They got a chance to meet him and C.T. Vivian, and so that definitely brought a completely different perspective of who Dr. King was. Listening to Harry Belafonte say what he had to say about this idea of not understanding the content of who that person is. We see streets everywhere, all over the country, that are there to honor our forefathers in some type of way. But if you don't understand what that person represented, then I think it's meaningless.
Is naming streets after King easy because they tend to be in Black communities?
Yes, I think so. I think that's the first thing. In Sarasota, Florida, there was a group of individuals who did not want a street named after King because of what it meant, what the stereotype meant, and they fought it. They felt like their housing values would go down. They felt like it automatically meant that it was in the poorer side of the city or whatever, and they fought it. There are people who fight having streets named after Dr. King because of that stereotype.
I want to bring this home a little bit. You live in Laurel.
Yes.
You work in College Park. I live in College Park. Obviously, you have been to Martin Luther King Boulevard in Baltimore. You lived near Martin Luther King Street in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. How do they reinforce these particular ones near us, reinforce or contradict Dr. King's vision of economic justice and racial equality?
I think in D.C. in particular, there is still a group of people who are not equal when it comes to money. You know, when we think about King's dream, we think about this idea of us being able to coexist in a way that is easy and is comfortable and is nice and we all like each other. But when we really think about what King was working towards, it was about economic empowerment and justice for all people. And you don't see that on these streets. You know, the people that live on streets named after King, particularly in Baltimore, the neighborhood surrounding MLK, they can't afford to buy houses in Fells Point. And I don't think that King would. In fact, I know that that's just not something that he would agree to.
In your opinion, what's the best way to honor Dr. King's legacy?
I think community service is the best way. I think that when we are talking about King, to take the time to find other speeches and quote him from those speeches, and let's not just talk about peace, let's not just talk about holding hands, let's not just talk about dreaming. One of the points in the film that we like to always quote is that dreaming plus marching equals sleepwalking. So I think it's really interesting that out of everything that we learn about King, the one thing that is quoted on of every side of every bus in every city is this dream. Well, you got to get up and go do some work at some point, right? So I think that's the better way of honoring King. You know, we need to teach our students that, you know, he was a scholar. You know, he fought for economic justice. And so I think that we can honor King that way by just going beyond this idea of dreaming. I mean, I think that's first. You got to wake up and you got to go do something.
I really appreciate your talking to us about it. Thank you, Shani.
Thank you so much.
Sharnice Fox Richardson, co-director of the documentary The MLK Streets Project. We have more information about the documentary on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. Just ahead, a most ethereal instrument. Stay with us on 88.1 for that.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall, and what we're about to hear may sound like someone singing, but in fact, it's an electronic instrument accompanied by a piano called the theremin. Rockmore playing music by Camille Saint-Saëns, the swan from his Carnival of the Animals. Clara was one of the foremost thereminists of her day between the two world wars. The theremin is a musical instrument that you don't actually touch to play. Its pitch and volume are guided by your hands as they move through the air between two antennas. It was invented in 1919 by a Russian scientist named Lev Sergeyevich Theremin, known as Leon Theremin here in the United States. Montreal writer Shawn Michaels found inspiration in the theremin and its creator for his debut novel, Us Conductors. It's a book brimming with unrequited love, international espionage, and enduring hope. I spoke with him about it last June. So this is a novel. It's a fictionalized account of this real-life Russian guy, a scientist named Leon Theremin, who is living in New York. He falls in love with the woman who will become the preeminent thereminist of her day, Clara Rockmore. Clara is also an actual person. We just heard her playing. How did the idea for the book come about?
I've always really been attracted to true stories that feel just so extraordinary that they have to be fictions. These kind of tales that almost feel mythic. I think by the same token, I've also been attracted to lies, fictions that feel true. I heard the broad strokes of Lev's story, of the story of Lev or Leon and Clara, and he just had such an extraordinary up and down of a life. It felt made up, but it also kind of jammed against some of the other questions and riddles that I'd been chewing on, and it seemed like a really interesting story to use to kind of explore some of the ideas and questions that I was thinking about, things about love and duty and responsibility and music and science.
And you give us full warning. You say that the book is full of distortions, illusions, omissions, and lies. This is a fictionalized life of Leon Theremin, but how did you view your responsibility in terms of historical accuracy and your license as a novelist, as a maker up of stories?
As a novelist, I think it's my responsibility to try to kind of summon or like evoke a kind of dreamlike narrative experience that the reader can get lost in. And I felt a responsibility to be as historically accurate as necessary for the reader to really get lost in it. Anything more than that is just picking up whatever was useful. So in this story, it was very useful to be able to draw on the real history of Lev. And Clara, it meant that there were fewer things I had to make up, because there's certainly already enough. Every sentence, you know, you're plucking from thin air. So I don't think I felt a responsibility to sort of represent the historical record or their biography. Biographies, this is very clearly a work of fiction, but I wanted to write a good book.
And how did you come to decide to add certain dimensions to Leon's story that didn't actually happen? I mean, I didn't know they didn't actually happen until I sort of looked into them later. But he kills a guy. He's a kung fu master in the book. And it turns out none of those things were actually true in his life. How did you decide sort of where to draw the line? That's an interesting challenge, I would think, as a writer.
Mm-hmm. Lev and Clara's story has kind of been painted as this almost like legendary story of true and possibly unrequited or unconsummated love. And I had heard this version of the historical tale, and I was a bit skeptical of it. My own life has shown that sort of ideas of true love are sometimes a certain lie hidden there. And so this book for me was a way of exploring that, the lying, the way that true love can kind of be a lying love. So knowing that I was doing that, and knowing that that's not based on interviews, it's an invention. I really wanted to be able to signal very clearly that this was my own imaginary. So things like the kung fu were my way of waving a big flag. Okay, in my story, this Russian inventor born in 1896 also does kung fu. I wanted to really make clear to the reader that I wasn't trying to represent what was truly in the heart of this man.
So Leon Theremin is the narrator of this book. I'm really interested in how you decided to structure it as well. Much of it is written while he's in the hold of a ship headed from New York back to Russia. And he's writing, putatively at least, to Clara
Rockmore. So in that sense, it's kind of an epistolary novel, but it's not really. You even talk about, you know, what happens if the letters are never delivered. You know, what happens if Clara never actually gets them? Because at that point in his life, everything's kind of up in the air. Why did you decide to tell it in this particular way?
Lev had a life that was full of ups and downs. He born in Russia, became a huge celebrity there, inventing the theremin that was kind of, it was essentially, I don't know, the iPad of 1925. It caused a huge sensation, and then he comes to America, greeted as a huge star. He lives at the Plaza Hotel in New York, meets Gershwins and Rockefellers, goes dancing at the dance halls. And then at a certain moment, he returns to Russia, where things go very badly, and ultimately he finds himself in a Siberian gulag. And so these are a lot of different points of different feeling. And so one of the challenges was to find a way to represent him at these moments. I didn't want it to be talking about New York and going dancing with Clara, or slipping into a speakeasy from a place where he's currently in a work camp in Siberia, reflecting back on that. I wanted to kind of be able to visit him from looking back on this story, but from different moments in his life. And so this way of splitting the novel, it's kind of two different letters, neither of which may ever be received, seemed like an interesting way to both ground him in a particular moment and also not ground him in only one moment.
That's an interesting choice and an effective one, because it definitely works. I want to talk a little bit about how you actually play the theremin. First of all, did you learn how to play it yourself when you were researching the book?
Yeah, I acquired my first theremin right at the end of last year. So I'd already written the book. I'd learned the concepts of it, but I didn't have one myself. So I've been learning since then.
On 88.1 WYPR, it's Marilyn Morning, listening now to Leon Theremin playing the instrument that he invented. I'm Tom Hall. Shawn Michaels is my guest. He's the author of the novel Us Conductors, about Leon Theremin. I wonder if you'd be kind enough to read a passage from the book where Leon describes how you actually play the theremin. This is on page 27.
Sure. My theremin is a musical instrument, an instrument of the air. Its two antennas emerge from a closed wooden box. The pitch antenna is tall and dark, noble. The closer your right hand gets, the higher the theremin's tone. The second antenna controls volume. It is bent, looped, gold, and horizontal. The closer you bring your left hand, the softer the instrument's song. The farther away, the louder it becomes. But always you are standing with your hands in the air, like a conductor. That is the secret of the theremin, after all. Your body is a conductor.
Shawn Michaels reading from his new novel, Us Conductors, about the inventor of the theremin, Leon Theremin. We found a clip of an interview with Clara Rockmore, who was, as you say, a violinist before she took up the theremin, and she talked here about her initial impressions of the instrument.
I was fascinated by the aesthetic part of the instrument, the visual, the beauty, and the idea of playing completely without touching anything. That part was very fascinating to me. I also loved the sound of it. And apparently I showed some kind of immediate, from point of view of Professor Theremin, an immediate ability to manipulate it, perhaps better than the usual person.
Of course, in a live performance of any instrument, there is a visual aspect to it. People watch people playing the guitar or playing the drums or playing the flute. When you're watching someone play the theremin, her hands are not touching anything. It's all in the air. And there's a certain dance-like quality to it. There's the movement aspect, some of which can be very subtle, is still very sort of hypnotizing and mesmerizing to watch, don't you think?
Yeah, it's really a beautiful the dance seems like the right word.
You write at the end of the first chapter that the sound of the theremin is simply pure electric current. It's the chanting of lightning as it hides in its cloud. The song never strains or falters. It persists, stays, keeps, lasts, and lingers. It indeed has lingered, the theremin, for more than, 80 years or something. Mm-hmm. What do you think it is about the theremin for you personally and for the body politic that has allowed it to persist as it has?
I think that there's actually something very special and singular about the theremin. All music is this strange invisible force, right? It's produced by musicians. It travels through the air invisibly, and then this invisible thing strikes us, hits us right in the ears, or maybe, hits us in the spirit. And there's it's this funny mixture of the physical. This physical thing produces this invisible force that then provokes emotion. And so the theremin, in a really, for me, startling way, kind of short circuits or messes with that relationship, because the starting moment, that moment of physical performance, is actually almost unphysical. It's movement, sort of little gestures in the air that don't seem to be doing anything, but then create the sound. It's almost like a sound that comes out of the air itself without a physical source, without a physical performance. It almost feels like a metaphor for music itself, this invisible force that can move us.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Of course, its presence in pop culture, do you think that's going to continue? Are you sensing something of a resurgence of people playing? I notice on your book tour, for example, you've got thereminists playing, including in Baltimore here tomorrow night, with you at virtually every stop on the way.
Yeah, well, theremin's had this long, this enduring sort of fun kind of sideshow aspect that's kept it around because it's such a fun, weird, mad scientist kind of device. But I do think that there's, especially in Europe, it's been interesting to see that there is a bit of a resurgence of the kind of virtuosic theremin player that Clara was, and that is still very rare because it's so hard to reach that level. So I find it interesting that we can still have the kind of hobbyist, nerdy, fun sound effect, gizmo aspect of the theremin, while this other kind of more noble tradition of careful, delicate, fragile theremin playing is kind of that's coming back.
Shawn Michaels, he's the author of the novel Us Conductors. We spoke in June. In November, Shawn Michaels won the 2014 Giller Prize. That's Canada's most prestigious literary award. We've got more about the book on our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Much more ahead. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're @MarilynMorning. Now, back to the show.
This is Marilyn Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. George Collins, who died last July at age 88, started his career in journalism as a reporter at the Afro-American 64 years ago and rose to become its editor-in-chief. In 1968, he switched to broadcasting, joining WMAR-TV as an anchor. 20 years later, he started a public affairs show on WEAA, the NPR member station on the campus of Morgan State. Governor O'Malley called Collins a guardian of truth and justice. O'Malley's written statement said in part, quote, George Collins embodied the best of journalism, offering insights and investigative reporting that changed the arc of history. George Collins exposed corruption, racism, and bigotry wherever he found it, reporting each of these stories with fairness and accuracy, end quote. Collins covered significant events in the civil rights movement, including the March on Washington and the funeral of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and closer to home, injustices in his community. Tom Hall spoke with Collins in October 2013 about the death a half century earlier of Hattie Carroll, a 51-year-old African-American woman injured while working as a waitress at a Baltimore ball. Collins had covered that story of a guest at the party becoming impatient with Mrs. Carroll and striking her on the head with his cane. She died hours later. Collins told Tom,
"Of course, it was old hat to those of us who had watched the rise and fall and the hesitation and the violence associated with racism in the country. So we regarded it as another, as a typical case of a white man abusing a black woman for no reason, which over the years in this country had become a pattern."
Charles Robinson, a correspondent from Maryland Public Television, knew and worked with Collins. I spoke with him shortly after Collins' death. I began by asking how and when he first met George Collins.
I was reading him because I was delivering the Afro-American newspapers. And, you know, and my patrons would say, if you want to sell this paper, read the paper. So I was reading all those little excerpts. But I got to know him personally as I became a professional and moved back to Baltimore. And probably one of the more storied stories about George is his effort to kind of break the idea that Maryland was not going to be accommodating to blacks as far as allowing blacks in the restaurants. And black journalists are caught in a dual world. In other words, they're practicing journalism and they're also practicing activism. So George came up with this idea that maybe we can show the hypocrisy by posing as African potentates slash diplomats.
Yeah, this was during the Kennedy administration in 1961, and the Kennedy administration was worried about black diplomats moving from Washington to the United Nations and not being treated well along U.S. Route 40 in Baltimore County and Harford County.
So the idea was real simple. George and a couple of his colleagues at the Afro said, well, let's see how it works and see if it really works. So they had found some African garb, but to make it work, they needed a limo. So they went to a local funeral home and asked, can we borrow the limo? And they could say, we're going to get a limo driver. We're going to make it look real. And of course, you know, they had all the prerequisite stuff and they walked in. And of course, the manager said, oh, please come have a seat, have dinner on it. And it was the Double T Diner that's on Route 40 and Rolling Road. And they sat there and had dinner and they got back in the car. And George said they had the biggest laugh, but they said, this is a much bigger story. And that begins to break down the laws in the state about not being able to serve blacks in restaurants.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. George Collins, a pioneering black journalist at the Afro-American newspaper, WMAR-TV and WEAA, died last July. We spoke about his life with his friend and colleague Charles Robinson, correspondent for Maryland Public Television. You interviewed him recently.
Yes, I did. It was on the during the dedication of the Martin Luther King Memorial in Washington, D.C. And what George told me about that was he said, Charles, people don't know that that march was not really as popular as people thought it was. People thought people were going to burn down the city of Washington. All these blacks coming. They didn't even know whites were coming. But they knew we're going to have all these black folks coming to D.C. My God, shut the liquor stores. That was the first edict that came down. Because remember, there's no home rule in D.C. at this point. It's being run by Congress. And George, of course, got on a bus with patrons from here. In those days, you know, African-American of a certain age will remind you, your mama always gave you a chicken sandwich on a piece of white bread in a brown bag and a soda. That was your meal for the day.
Because you couldn't count on being able to buy.
You were not going to be able to go into a restaurant, and that was it. But let me also talk about George and his television career, because it kind of mirrors mine to a certain extent. You know, most people around in this city know you've seen African Americans on television. In fact, he and another guy by the name of Wiley Daniels kind of broke that color barrier in television here. But you can go around this country, and very few people will see people. I can tell you, I saw both of them and had the gumption to think, you know what? I can do this. And went to a school in the capital Confederacy in Richmond, Virginia. And I had white professors look at me why do you think you can do this? And that was what you need. And I always remind folk, you know, male, female, others, you emulate what you think is the best. And so people see you and they think, I think I can do this. And there's some young lady, young man somewhere who's listening to us and saying, you know what? I think I can do this. And that's really the great legacy of George Collins.
Wow. You mentioned, we have just a minute or so left, but you mentioned the sort of dual responsibility he had, reporting activist, and being accurate, activist, but also being activist.
Yeah. And
Did he talk to you about that?
He said, you know, this guy named Moses Newsom, and they were on the roads going through the Deep South. The Afro would send their correspondents literally to cover the news wherever it was. And the thing is that when there's nobody there and you're there by yourself and you're facing, you know, people taunting you, calling you names, it changes your perspective. I mean, it really does, because you realize, of course, you become a part of the story, but you must try and stay objective. But you've got to kind of have that edge to say, not so much it's wrong, but explain why it's wrong. And I think that's part of the legacy of George Collins.
Part of what your generation learned from him.
Absolutely. I'm in the third generation of African-American journalists. He was kind of in the second. The first one was they found all these black journalists. They were writing for black newspapers. And when the riots happened here in 68, then they said, well, let's find some people on television. So they go look at the black newspapers. And that's where they got most of their reporters. And
that's where they got George Collins. I really appreciate your coming in
Charles. Thank you so very much for talking about my friend.
Charles Robinson. He's a correspondent for Maryland Public Television. We spoke in August, not long after the death of George Collins. Collins was a former editor-in-chief of the Afro-American newspaper and a broadcaster at WMAR-TV and WEAA. He was 88. I'm Sheila Cast. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy.
We have production help from
Connor Graham.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
On this day, in 1997, actor and musician Will Smith married actress Jada Pinkett in Baltimore. I'm Sheila Cast. Happy New Year. See you in 2015.